She was 15, with a smile full of sex, although she probably didn't know it yet. Highlighted hair scraped back, a not-so-natural curl thrust forward, and around her neck, a silver chain with a tiny crystal from Argos. She probably loved that necklace. She would lie naked in front of her mirror in the evenings, her white skin glowing, as she pretended it was a gift from Steve-O, Danny or Will, depending on the week. She had the tinted lip gloss and black-rimmed eyes of a young girl from Twickenham, and quite perfect teeth. But aren't they always in these kind of photos? Emily's fit, the boys of Orleans Park School would have said. Emily was too young to be beautiful. Not enough death in her. Not at that moment, at least. But as I stand here, now, looking down at her image, I think that there's something there. Something in the way her eyebrow pencil overshoots the mark. Something in the brown line that juts down, just a little too far, that almost captures it. Dead already? Emily smiles at me. The death knock is when a reporter knocks on the door of a relative of someone who has recently died. The more tragic the death, the better, to extract as much information as he can. Tony's words from my first day at the office come back to me. Everyone on the paper wants a death knock. It's guaranteed to make the front page. Emily smiles at the nation. She was in a hurry to go out, Friday night with her mates. Dad bothering her, always about. Have you got your key? Have you got your key, Emily? I'll give you your fucking key, she thought. But Emily smiled at her father's new digital camera without an ounce of teenage irony, for her dad was sweet, really. In fact, in that moment, when she turned around, before leaving the house, Emily smiled at the nation. She smiled at mums and dads over their Marmite and toast and tea. She smiled at kids who would get nightmares from that smile of hers, as she used to from other such smiles, maybe. Emily was going to get a Nando's and take it back to Hannah's. She was, in fact, going to Old Deer Park to get pissed and possibly fingered. She was going to walk home later that night, giddy, an unfamiliar smell of spunk on her hands. She was going to get the back of her head smashed in. Ragged, they said, beneath the remnants of a ponytail. A botched job. Like a man with a can and no opener, he finally made his way in. She was a good girl, a sweet girl, clever and kind. She was a high achiever, a considerate girl, a voice is saying. But I'm not really listening. In fact, I couldn't care less. All I'm thinking is how much I want the death knock, and I'll do anything to get it. Oi, my turn. Liz pulls a photo from my hand, and I'm back in the newsroom, surrounded by a pack of staring hacks, back to the smell of Cornish pasty that has been lingering about the office lately. We're standing around the hub, passing her photo around. None of us are sitting down, apart from James, the news editor, and Paul, his deputy, even though there are more than enough chairs to go round. But we're pretending we're at a national paper. No one sits down in conference at the Mail, apparently. Utterly tragic, James is whining, as people like to. Tragic, so very tragic. But this is no tragedy, I think. Yes, her mother will never be the same woman again, as they like to say, which means something like Mary Wakefield would never be the harmlessly flirty dinner host she used to be. She will never smile without a damaged look in her eyes. She will never not be subject to the dreams where she's waiting in Topshop changing room for Emily to try on another pair of jeans. But Mum, I look like a loser in these. Where she's going through yet another A-level course description with her most obsessive child of the three. Where she's at Pizza Express with Emily's friends, Hannah, Sarah, Natalie and Katie B. But where's Emily? Where's Emily? I'm here, Mum, you weirdo. Her daughter's long brown arms around her neck. Her hug that's more like a tight squeeze. And then the awakening. So where's the redemption? Where's the character flaw? Incomprehensible, unspeakably painful, senseless, fucking terrifying, might be a start. But it doesn't have quite the rousing ring of tragedy. Killed just minutes away from her home. James again, almost smiling. James got a first from Oxford, he told me, when I first arrived here 4 weeks ago. James is 43. I was standing by his chair, looking down at red flakes of skin under thinning black hair, as he said, I once did an internship at the Mail. Good one, James, I said. Call me Jim. But I'm not into abbreviations. James wears black-trimmed glasses and a beige linen suit. He's writing a screenplay, obviously. Tony, who sits on my table, a general reporter like me, is looking directly at Julia, education correspondent. But Julia refuses to return his look. Julia seems pretty calm, but she's glancing intermittently at Liz from Features, who has her usual half smile on her lips. Liz is cool and collected and slowly turning red. She gives a sideways glance at Sean, who slouches on one leg, arms crossed, like he couldn't give a shit. Sean, health correspondent, shifts his weight onto his other leg and then back to the first, then the other, then the first, a little too quickly, a little too much like a kid desperate for a wee. David grins at him sardonically. David is playing big guy on the block. David, who'll write about anything, is grinning at everyone as if it's one big joke, when clearly it is not. In fact, it means everything to him, as it does everyone else here. Nothing ever happens in Twickenham, you see, Tony informed me, as if I need telling. So, this is a big deal. You get the job, you make it to the Nationals, in all likelihood. So David is looking at Sean, who's looking at Liz, who eyes Foggo, chief reporter, the top dog. Foggo stares at no one, then at Nina, who makes eye contact with Liz, and I realise I've had too much coffee, and Nina glances at Julia, and Julia at Tony, and Tony at Foggo, and the strip lighting starts to fizz as Liz glances at Julia, and the white flecks on the carpet begin to spin like static on the TV. And David's grinning, and Sean's jigging, and Liz is staring, and Julia's winking, and Foggo's glaring, and they're all joining in. And I put up my hand and say, me please. Eyes fall on me. The work experience girl, as I'm repeatedly mistaken for. Despite the fact I'm older than the other general reporters here. But I started late at this career. I'd like to do the death knock. I feel Julia's arch smile. Liz suddenly dives in her bag, her shoulders shaking. Fogger looks at me like I'm three. I glance at Nina, who's supposed to be my friend here. She sends me emails every day, despite the fact I sit right next to her. Want a drink after work? Want to catch some lunch? As if we're in some kind of conspiracy. But Nina's smirking. And my face is burning. And I look to Tony, who's also supposed to be my mate here. Like a subtitle, he reels off a constant commentary on the office happenings. But Tony's smirking, and I can't look to anyone. And I can only think of my red cheeks. And I pack it in, make some inaudible self-deprecating remark, as I'm prone to, return to my place as work experience wallflower. The Times has a big piece this morning, James says. Double spread. Pretty woolly stuff. A few words from a much older half-brother. The parents are yet to speak. Oh, yeah, and Annie, is it? He flicks through the Times. Thanks for the interest. But we need an experienced journalist on this. He smiles. "Okay, guys, this is big news. Probably the biggest that has hit Twickenham since, since the Stones played here in 63. Did you know that, guys? At the Up Island Hotel. What a funky night that would have been. Totally mental. Right then, you lot. Okay, team. Young Emily." I touch my face. They're no longer looking at me. I move my hand inside my pocket and feel for the lock of hair I cut from Michael's head this morning. Snipped it while he was sleeping. Pressed it in a strip of sellotape. James reads from his notepad. "This Tuesday evening, on the 2nd of February, at 11 p.m, a young teacher from St Mary's Primary was making her way home through Twickenham Green. After drinks out with colleagues, when she approached a young girl who was curled up on the grass. Drunk, the woman thought. She tried to help her up. The girl was heavy, she wouldn't budge. So the teacher lay her shoulders back down on the grass and then found herself covered in this black stuff. On her hands, her arms, her new brown leather coat. Like a split ink cartridge, she said. It was dark, she couldn't really see, so she shone her mobile phone and saw blood all over her. Her own blood, she thought, momentarily. And then she saw the girl's head, or what was left of it. I gripped my strip of sellotape. Later this morning, when I went back to kiss Michael goodbye, he pulled me to him, trapped me, as he would say, locking me in his heavy arms. Anna, he breathed, Michael, I have to leave now, but like a child, he wouldn't let me go. I think you'll make a brilliant journalist, he murmured, his black hair ruffled, his head heavy with sleep. After I maneuvered myself out of his grasp, kissed him on the cheek, opened the bedroom door quietly so as not to wake him, he mumbled after me, "If you want to, that is." James continues. Emily Wakefield was taken to hospital with serious head injuries, but pronounced dead shortly after arrival. Killed by a blow to the back of the head minutes from her home. At present, the police have very few leads. A blue Volvo near the scene, that's all they're saying. The family will make their appeal tomorrow morning. We'll send round a reporter in the afternoon. Emily had just got straight A's in her mock GCSEs. Michael's words from this morning come back to me. If you want to, that is. Want to? Be a news reporter? No, not really. Not how I can want things. But Emily smiled. And I know I want this. Think of it less like a cold call, James says. More like lending an ear. We're from round here. We won't turn up with our press passes and our Blackberries. The Richmond and Twickenham Times has a responsibility for local parents and kids. We have to gain the Wakefields' trust. We have to make them feel at ease. Guys, this is our big chance. We have to find out something the Nationals can't. A brilliant journalist, Michael told me. I think I can make a good job of it. My own voice and my ears. James puts down his pad. I've ruined his carefully prepared speech. Rehearsed in front of the mirror this morning, no doubt, after he'd yanked a plastic-coated wire between his teeth, turned his head slightly, clenched his mouth so that his jaw muscle protruded, the way he likes it. He began his first draft. A child was murdered in our neighbourhood, he informs me. We need an old hand on this job. David, who's been here 11 years, giggles like a girl. But thank you for your eagerness. This time, James is looking at Liz instead of me. She quickly looks down at her notepad, and I realise they're fucking each other. and have been for some time. But Liz is no real threat. She's on features. This is a news story. Why do you think you could do it? Paul, James's deputy, addresses me. Paul, who has said nothing so far, while James has twittered on endlessly. Paul, who commands respect precisely because he says nothing. I know the family, I say. I hear the lie on my lips before I've had a chance to think about it. How? Paul says. I went to school with her older brother. How well? Paul continues. Pretty well. Friends of the family. I live down the road. I'm already beginning to picture the scene. Ollie and I, in and out of each other's houses, playing water pistols in the street. Emily merely a half thought in her mother's mind. Paul turns to James. It might work. The smirks have disappeared. The smiles reversed. Everyone knows Paul runs a show around here. Paul has been on the paper 20 years. James, 6 months. Paul just doesn't have that thing that can turn people into twats. Drive, some call it. Paul has no desire to be editor. He just loves local news. He just loves the good life. He just loves his girlfriend. Just? Paul is bloody good at his job. He just doesn't possess that squalid little lack inside himself that he's desperately trying to fill up, like the rest of us have. I think they would trust me, I say. Foggo's mouth smiles. His eyes say, don't mess with me. I really think I could get them to open up. Well, James tries to lean back in his seat, but it's not that kind of seat, so his head is thrust forward like he's in a neck brace. Well, I think she did a good job on the twins. James turns to Paul. Paul says nothing. James is trying to regain control, make it look like it was his idea to bring me in. He's referring to the story I covered last week. Twins pass their driving test on the same day. In Twickenham, this makes for the front page, but not exactly breaking news. He looks at Paul. Paul says nothing. Okay, Annie, James says. I'd like you in on this. It's Anna, I say. I look at James. James looks back. The others rest their eyes on anything except each other and me. The hacks return to their seats. I head to the toilets, where I've been spending a fair bit of time recently. I've told them I have a bladder infection, but really it's a place I go to think over things. I close the flat-pack wooden door. It feels like a ship's cabin in here. No gaps at the top or bottom of the cubicle, firmly shut in, away from the overhead lights that are so bright the room has no shadows, away from the orange and brown carpet reminiscent of the old National Rail carriages and attendant smell of cheese and onion crisps. I close my eyes. I'm suddenly, overwhelmingly tired. The inevitable coffee slump, maybe. I realise I feel disappointed. Deflated. Like when you've wanted something for a long time, and then you get it. The slight twinge of dissatisfaction I feel when the bus I've been moaning about suddenly swings around the corner. And why did I want the death knock so desperately? But I know why, really. Even I'm not detached enough not to know this. The idea of ever opening my eyes again feels like an impossibility. I try and keep my thoughts on tomorrow, on the job ahead of me, but the notion feels too heavy, too layered. I can't keep hold of it. Then the red pixel patterns appear, the best stage of sleep, the luminous snakes that swim under my eyelids, turning, distending, splitting in two, for as long as I can retain this perfect state of semi-consciousness. Then Nina's shiny nose as she says, "So, they've given the death knot to the work experience kid." Then Michael texting on his mobile phone as I try again and again to tell him something. Then Emily's smile. She smiles at me. But this time her whole face is smiling, not just her teeth. Her lips look thinner. There's a double dimple in one cheek. And then it's no longer Emily. And it's you. And I'm not ready for it. I try to bring back Emily, Nina, anyone but you, not my little sister, for God's sake, please. But there's that spot on your forehead you always meddled with. "Fool," you say, as you pick it one more time and it starts to bleed. You're standing in front of the hallway mirror, wearing a silly green pashmina. "Sloane," I call you from the bottom of the stairs, and you come after me with your tiny spot and your emphatic laugh, your contagious laugh you've had since you were a little bobbed-haired kid, which would either make me want to smack you if we were having one of our unsaid arguments, or join in relentlessly. "Becky, Bex, always Rebecca to me." Rebecca's body was found by her bedroom window. She wasn't asleep. And my eyes open. I check my phone. I've been here 15 minutes. I take out my pocket mirror, clean up the lines of mascara that run down my cheeks, apply some red lipstick, and leave my wooden booth. I'm going to nail this job, I decide, as I walk past staring faces to my seat. They're going to thank their lucky stars I ever entered this newsroom.